The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's lovely to be with you tonight in the beautiful city of Philadelphia, and I want to welcome you all for coming. I want to also welcome a number of people who I know will be listening to this on podcast around the place, and even back home in Dublin, Ireland, where I'm from. And as I say, it's great to be here with you and to share the stage with Frank Delaney, a writer for whom I have great admiration. So I'm going to read to you a little bit from my new novel just published here, which is called Ghost Light. And just to contextualize it for you, it's a novel that's very loosely based on a real-life story. One of our greatest Irish writers from the last century was a man some of you will have heard of called John Millington Synge, a great playwright, the man who wrote The Playboy of the Western World and a handful of other plays that really changed Irish dramatic writing forever. And Synge was a rather buttoned-up, reserved, reticent man. He came from a prosperous background, but he had known a lot of loneliness and suffering in his life. His father died when he was a baby, so he never knew his father. His mother was a very strict, puritanical, religious person. And Synge, as a young man, suffered a crisis of faith when he read the works of Darwin, and he realized that he had very little in common with his family anymore. So Synge and the great poet Yeats and the great writer and intellectual Lady Gregory were involved in the early years of the last century with establishing the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, a place I know some of you will have visited. And it was through that Synge, in the last few years of his life, met and fell tempestuously in love with a much younger woman from the inner city of Dublin, a Catholic whose name was Molly Allgood. It's a fantastic name, isn't it, Molly Allgood? I sometimes think one of the reasons I wrote Ghostlight was just anybody with a name as beautiful as that deserves to have a novel written about them. So Molly and her sister Sarah Allgood were from the tenement part of Dublin, the part of Dublin that Sean O'Casey would have written about in his plays, the part of Dublin that my own grandparents were from. And she was, apart from the difference of class and background, she was temperamentally extremely different from Synge. She was a very fiery, tempestuous, flirtatious, light-hearted young woman. And so on paper, this love affair could never have happened. But we all know that the most powerful song of all is the song of heart's desire. And so in the last few years of Synge's life, they meet and they fall in love. And they have this love affair, which really changes everything for him. So the novel is very loosely based on that. It opens in London in 1952. Synge died young. He died at the age of 37 of Hodgkin's disease. But Molly lived to the 1950s and she continued to act. She had great years here in America on Broadway, often played in Philadelphia and the other great American cities. But as the novel opens, she's an elderly woman and her great performances are behind her. She's a bit down on her luck. She likes the odd drink. And we wake up with her, I suppose, on an autumnal morning in 1952 in London. And a memory of this man who was so important to her when she was a young woman comes back. So I think that's all you need to know. Oh, there's one other little thing. Synge and Molly, during their courtship, they had little endearments for each other, as sweethearts often do. She used to call him Tramp, which is a kind of ironic, affectionate mockery of his prosperous background. And he used to call her Changeling. And a changeling is a figure from Irish folklore. Somebody who has the gift of being able to change their shape is a changeling. So there we go. So I'm going to read you three extracts. The first is from London, 1952. The second is a flashback, just to a day in their courtship. And the third is from the very end of the book, the epilogue. And while I don't want to give away the end, suffice it to say that the third extract is a letter. So when I get to that point, I'll be reading in Molly's voice. And many years after both participants in this love affair have died, somebody is going through Molly's old papers and they find a letter that she wrote when she was a young woman to this man who it turned out that she couldn't be with in the end. So here we are. This is from chapter one of Ghostlight. A lodging house room in London, 27th of October, 1952, 6:43 a.m. In the top floor room of the dilapidated townhouse across the terrace, a light has been on all night. From your bed, it was visible whenever you turned towards the window, which you had to do in order to fetch your bottle from the floor. Most nights the same. The bulb is lighted at dusk. In the mornings, a couple of moments after the street lamps flicker out, it dies and the ragged curtain is closed. You are 65 now, perhaps the age of that house, perhaps even a little older. What a thought. You approach your only window. It is shockingly cold to the touch. Winter is coming to England. The weather has been bitter. Last night, a hurricane struck London. You have never noticed anyone enter or exit that forlorn house, but the postman still delivers to it, stuffing envelopes through the broken glass in the door panel. The letterbox has been nailed closed many years. Men urinate in the porch. One of the street girls plies her trade there, and the balustrade has long been splashed with obscene words. Many of the window embrasures are boarded. Weeds sprout from the facade. You have a sense that the occupant of the room is a man. For one midnight, a fleeting shadow crossed the upper window pane, so you thought, and there was maleness in how it moved. There was a time when you used to think about him. How can he live alone in a bomb-blasted old house? Who sends the letters? What are they about? For it helped to pass the brutal hours immediately preceding dawn. But this morning, someone else has come to you again, out of the same light somehow, out of an unseen room, out of a city you have lived in the last 13 years, but have never found a reason to call your own. This has happened to all of us, a coasting across the mind by one we had thought forgotten or purposefully banished. But today will prove him a wanderer reluctant to be exiled, an emigrant still attempting to come home. He could be difficult sometimes. What use in denying it? Irritable, unforgiving for a relatively young man. Because the whisperers and gossips and sniggerers always made such a point of the age difference between you. Envious vixens, triple-chinned hypocrites, too deceitful to utter their true objection. For what are years, fictions, ink stains on a calendar? There are moments of late when yesterday feels a life ago, and tomorrow an unborn century, so unreachable it seems. And had he lived beyond his youth, the years would have contracted, because a married couple become the same age, grow to resemble one another over time, like bookends, their recollections in grayed bindings between them, and neither bothering to read what once divided them. What's this he'd be now? 80-something. A slippered old duffer, a shuffler, an old bags. Hard to work the calculation through the fog of a hangover. Your reckoning of the decades keeps stalling, tripping up. After a few ruined attempts, you abandon it. You take a small, sour sip, medicinal, just a settler. The reek of gin dampens your eyes, somehow intensifies his presence, but you grimace it away with a swallow. The daily spite of this unmannerly town. Wasn't it Yeats wrote that? Or my other lunk, Shaw? Dublin, he was whining about. But all towns are unmannerly to the old, the poor, the collaborator. What is it in poets that must dress a thing up? Christ, they'd nearly call their dandruff the fairy snow. Not long after dawn, the shadow-kissing time. Grey light at the window and the whistle of the kettle as you move about, failing to keep warm. Mittens flittered to ribbons. You wear a dead man's boots. Well, no point in wastefulness, a sin. Down below in Brickfield's terrace, a milk wagon is delivering. And you wonder would the man advance you another month's credit, but the fear of being declined dissuades you. Frost silvers the pavement, the telephone kiosk, the street. The wrecked colonnades of the house where the light burns all night. An awning over the grocer's on the corner of Porchester Road. Rooks are circling the chimney breasts. You shuffle away from the window to the cubbyhole by the cooking ring. The room smells of cabbage and dust. Somewhere below you, a wireless is playing too loudly, but you do not object to the interruption, find it oddly cheering sometimes. There are hours late at night when you miss its consolation. Silence can be frightening to the lonely. He always said you were over-imaginative, too given to fantasy, a Catholic trait, he would joke. These nights you read Mills and Boons from the Tuppenny Library in Earl's Court Road. Sure, you'd be lost for a bit of an escape, only it wasn't for true romances. How he would have hated them, your dog-eared and tear-stained bedfellows. Opium for spinsters he'd mock. The sun would dry the oceans wide. Heaven would cease to be. The world would cease its motion, my love, ere I'd prove false to thee. A song on the radio that would draw the heart out of you, Molly, that anyone ever felt such devotion. Chapter 3. Kingstown, a prosperous suburb of Dublin, 1908. There is a part of the garden by the cluster of sycamores, near the bend in the drive where the gravel is wearing thin. And if he stands there quietly on a still Sunday morning, when none of the servants is around to annoy him, and when Mother is up in her room at her scriptures, he can hear the distant approach of the train from Dublin, the wind-borne shush and chug that means she might be coming to him again. He is 36 now, already very ill. Painful years have passed since he stopped believing he could be loved. The power of what is happening terrifies him. He leaves his mother's garden, makes hurriedly for Glenageary Station, up the willow-lined avenue towards St. Paul's Church of Ireland, past the entrance to the quarry lanes known locally as the Metals, through which the granites were hefted long ago for the stanchions of Kingstown Pier. There are days when he feels hammered, his breathing sometimes knifes him. But punctuality is important, a sign of respect, he says. The walk from his mother's house takes about 7 minutes. Often he arrives as the locomotive is chuntering to its screechy standstill and belching grimy spumes of cinders and mizzle. He skulks in the station portico, not daring to hope, lowering his eyes quickly if a neighbour happens past. It would not do to be seen, not yet, not here. There is the age difference between them, but that is not all. There are the differences that cannot be noticed in an instant. And then Where can she be? She materializes through the smoke. There she is, beckoning circumspectly from a second-class window. It is like a small moment out of Tolstoy, perhaps. One of those seemingly simple but reverberating images he values in the novels of Russia. He pictures her stepping down through the vapor, the soot, then hurrying along the platform to him, parasol in hand. She comes to him through the filth, her face hopeful and kind, the steam moistening a strand of hair to her forehead. But this cannot happen, people might see. There would be talk around Glenageary. Instead, he boards the train, takes the bench opposite her in the carriage. They're like a couple of collaborators plotting an act of treason. Outside, the conductor is slamming the doors. A whistle is blown. A green flag is flourished. As the engine gives a shriek and they judder away from Glenageary, he begins to feel something like relief. From the pocket of her raincoat is protruding a play script. She uses the journey from the city to learn her lines. And nobody could say she is beautiful exactly, but she is an actress. She is able to decide whether to be beautiful or plain. Like a changeling, he calls her, his preferred endearment. Like many sweet nothings, an ambiguity. And the train clatters into the tunnel at Killiney. He is alone with her in darkness. He feels her hand steal into his. This thrills him, charges him. No one can see. The moment passes quickly. There is a dazzle of light, and the panorama of the bay is magnificent, Italian. Along the cliff tops at Shangana, a cormorant hangs in the air. It will not be too long before they come coasting into Bray, where nobody knows him. Bray is safe. Passers-by might think them a father and daughter as they exit Bray station, and she links him at the elbow, and they go walking down the promenade in the direction of Bray Head, through a swirl of dirty gulls and old newspapers. He looks older than his years. She looks younger than hers. He has achieved some recognition in the field of playwriting. Translations of two of his works have been performed in Prague and Berlin. He is co-director of the Irish National Theatre Society. But few in this frumpy little town would know he was a writer, and fewer, if they knew, would care. His companion has appeared in three of his plays, bit parts at first, but she was soon elevated to leads, past cold grey wavelets breaking on the stones, past the suck in the runnels of Strand. This is from the epilogue. Old letter found among her papers, unmailed. Duane's Inn and Grocery, near Carrow, Cashla Bay, Connemara, Galway, 24th of July, 1907. Dearest Tramp, I am after writing out your name and looking at the page 100 years. I am unsure I should go on at all, or if you'd like a line or two from your bad old penny. So how are you keeping this weather and you without me up in Dublin? Are you fading away like the morning dew? I hope you won't be thick with me now for writing and you're buried in your old play like a miner. 'Tis midnight in Connemara. Downstairs they're at the drinking and the singing of sad songs. They live only for pleasure, the stony grey islanders and the dark deep sup of the blackness. It said there's a storm coming. No one seems to care. An hour ago, a girl was singing The Lass of Rock Royal, and everything went still, oh, as still as the air. And you came drifting in and sat down by my window. I was thinking about the night in Cork City when that old drunkard was singing it near the market. Do you remember his hands? They were like gnarled bits of bog oak. We were going somewhere or coming home. Was it after the theatre, maybe? And there was a fella too old to be begging, and he collecting money in a cap. And a dog on a rope with a scarf around his neck. And yourself, Big Owl's soft heart, were crying. The sun would dry the oceans wide. Heaven should cease to be. The world will cease its motion, my love, ere I'd prove false to thee. I was thinking about when we quarrelled, you silly jealous lunk. I hate it when we quarrel. It makes me afraid you want to leave me. I'd no more go with another fella. You are too silly a goose for words. I might play a little game of winks and bat my eyes, but that is all. And I'll quit it if you really do wish me to. The thought I'd make you unhappy, you blethering old baboon, when it's myself is at your mercy, and always will be. And I hate it when you say I'd be better off with some easy-going chap. God, it makes me want to scream the face off you, so it does. Some harmless, nice fella and his collars in a drawer and his mammy sewing him up for the winter. What would I do with him when it's my crabby old scrivener I only want? You do say it for the divilment of maddening me, don't you? Didn't I know it the moment I saw you, before you'd ever given me the time of day? Long before you ever touched me, or even I heard your name spoken. Girls, nonsense, I hear you saying, never happens in life, only in storybooks and songs. And the queerest thing of all is, I agree with my tramper. I haven't hide nor hair of reasons for what's between us now. And if ever you wanted to quit your impatient girl truly, and our little story had to be put away in a room that's only sometimes remembered, well, that's still a room I'd want, and I'd go there now and again, like some room in an old hotel on a seafront someplace, where two sinners did something they shouldn't. Do you mind what I'm telling you? It is the God's honest truth. Even if I never saw you or heard from you again, you'd already have been the miracle of my life. Oh, I can see you rolling your 700-year-old eyes and saying I make it all sound like a novel for dressmakers, you bitter-mouthed old granny. But to find you in my mind at some moment of the morning, to see some sentence in a script and wonder what my tramper would say to it, or to feel you glowing on like a lamp in my head and know I'd sleep in your arms that night. There's nothing in the world would ever give me the joy of that. Nothing in the great round world. You're forever at me to talk. Only I'm sometimes afraid. The things I should have told you when we were walking Killiney Strand, like that knowing you is the greatest blessing of anything in my life. And I can't think up the phrases and the fiery words you'd have yourself, for there's not languages enough in all the living world to tell you of your preciousness to me. And everything about you gives me courage I never ever had. And without you, I'm like a ghost drifting through some old house of a life. And there's nothing about you I don't love. You are so kindly and good and wise, and I love you, and so patient and so loyal and so manly. So now you know all. Can I send you this letter? Are you reading it still? Am I gone mad? When we marry, can we go to America and stay there a time? That's if you still want me, my ploughboy. Oh, wouldn't we be the nice pair of ornaments in New York or Brooklyn or some place? To flit away from this rainy sad land and the gossips and the dullards and the pokers of noses and old maids. There's times I think it'll choke us. If only we could go. In America, we would live to 150. Do you think I could ever play a lead in New York or Chicago? Ah, my tramper, wouldn't that be a thing entirely? We'd be two fools with the laughter, and we'd be traipsing down the Broadway and back to some little flat in the midnight. It makes me weep with heart's joy when I think I have found you and all the lovers' adventures we will share. Do you know the way I have sometimes wept when we've been together alone? For all the pleasures you have given me have left me nothing else to do. That is how I feel this night. How I wish I had you here. I would measure your neck with my kisses. God, I can't sleep tonight. What is ailing your girl? Do you mind? You asked me one time to sing you a song, and I was nervous, for I hadn't had lessons. It was the first day we ever spoke to one another, in Sackville Street, by the post office. But if you were here, I'd sing it now. Would you like that, old tramper? Because the words on a page are only words on a page, but a song needs someone to love it by hearing. It was yourself told me that once. It was that night we were in Cork. An old drunkard was singing it, and not a soul of the world listening. But you and me were. And it's in my head now. And as long as I live, and no matter what happens us, I'll hear it every time I hear the rain. The sun would dry the oceans wide. Heaven should cease to be. The world will cease its motion, my love, ere I would prove false to thee. Well, it's coming on for dawn. I better go to sleep. Do you think I should send this when you don't want interrupting? You're right, I shouldn't. But tomorrow I'm going to, as soon as the storm is over. Whisht, I think it's lulling. Wait now till I listen. Everything is quiet, only the waves on the stones. It's little enough Irish I'll be learning today, I'm thinking. I can hear the terns calling, beautiful sound. Come with me up to the cliffs, and we'll watch them an hour. We won't say a word, let the sea be all our talk. Just the gulls and the fishermen's boats heading out, and the trawl nets unrolling behind them. I kiss this paper, dear man. Touch it to your lips. I am half afraid to send it. I don't know why. The sun is coming up. Your changeling. Thank you. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I grew up among people who met men like John Millington Synge, who lived in that time, and who spoke like that. I can tell you, what you've just heard is perfect pitch. And that's what you get from Joseph O'Connor's novels. I haven't yet had the pleasure of reading Ghostlight, but I read his novel, Star of the Sea, and shortly after reading it, I went on record in a number of places as saying, it is one of the best novels by an Irish writer of the last two or three generations. I hope it's on sale here tonight. It is a magnificent piece of work, and it's a privilege and a pleasure to be on the same platform as him. I'm delighted to be back in Philadelphia. It's a city of which I've had great experience. In 1978, I made a documentary here. You're familiar, being Philadelphians, with the American Declaration of Independence. Those of us who are studying for our citizenship know that there are two declarations of independence. There's the aggregated one with all the signatures, and there's the single-page one. And the single-page one is signed on the bottom right-hand corner by a man whose name became synonymous with the very word signature, John Hancock. Look at it closely, because in the bottom left-hand corner, there is another signature, a man called Charles Thompson, whose house you can visit out in Bryn Mawr. Charles Thompson was from Limavady in County Derry. We made a long and later very well-received BBC documentary about him called The Man America Forgot. He was the first Secretary of State. He founded the Post Office. He founded the State Department. He ran the elections that got Washington made president. He signed the first treaty with the Indians. The Delaware Indians gave him a name which meant the man who tells the truth. And when it all was over, and Franklin and Jefferson asked him, would he write the history of the Founding Fathers, because he was the man who took the minutes at the First and Second Continental Congresses, he went and looked at the archives he had kept, and he was seen by the staff in the National Archive, which he founded, ripping out the pages of his ledgers. And he said, when asked by Franklin and Jefferson why he wouldn't write this and why he had torn out the pages, he said, in time to come, America, the new America, will want to see you gentlemen, you founding fathers, as heroes. According to the records I took of the First and Second Continental Congresses, that would not have been possible. You should go and visit his house. It's out of Bryn Mawr. I'm here to talk about a book called The Matchmaker of Kenmare. Kenmare is a little town in the southwest of Ireland in County Kerry. Its Irish name is more evocative. It's Nedeen. And Nedeen is a little nest. And Kenmare is a little nest in the beautiful mountains of the southwest. The matchmaker of Kenmare is a girl called Kate Begley, and she lives in a place called Lamb's Head. She's an entirely fictional character, but drawn from many strands of my own life. My job as a writer, as I always describe it to myself, is I'm not so much a writer as a smuggler. Because I came through broadcasting, where I was imbued with the idea that it is desirable to gain as wide an audience as possible, but to speak to them in the most intelligent way possible, what I like to do is smuggle. I like to take fairly large ideas and put them in the pages of books that I hope are very accessible. We had a mantra at the BBC when I worked there, which I did for more than 25, 30 years and still do some work for them, which was never underestimate your audience's intelligence. Always underestimate their knowledge. It was a piece of great respect. What it does is it licenses you to tell people all kinds of things under the guise of whatever piece of work you're involved in. So I have this mission in life to smuggle as much as I can to as many people as I can. In other words, I want people of all ages and all standards of education to be able to read my books and get something out of them. So in every single book I write, and at the moment I'm writing a series of novels, discussing the presence of Ireland and the Ireland I knew in the 20th century, in these novels that kind of tell the story of a decade at a time or what happened in that particular decade. I wrote a novel called Shannon some years ago, which is about 1922, and the Civil War in 22 is the background against which it has played out. The last book, Venetia Kelly's Travelling Show, which is the prequel to this, if you like, although it never intended to be, but Venetia Kelly didn't end in a way that I had anticipated, so I had to go and write a sequel to it. And this hasn't ended in the way I anticipated, so I've had to write a sequel to this, which I'm working on at the moment. So suddenly I have a trilogy in my hand. But all of these books begin in exactly the same way. They begin with an author's note, which is my valediction to you, my little goodbye now. I've done my 50% of the job. I've put my imagination into it. Now you please come and bring your 50% and your imagination, and then we'll both have had a very good time indeed. There's an English writer called Henry Green who described beautifully, I think, the relationship between author and reader as intimacy between strangers. After tonight, we won't be strangers to each other. At least I won't be a stranger to you. And now let me share with you some of the intimacy that's also for a wider world. The author's note to the matchmaker of Kenmare says a lot about the book itself. Here it is. The word neutral, from neuter, originally meant neither masculine nor feminine. Time and its upheavals created a new and political meaning. Neutral meant staying out of a war. In 1939, Ireland, a small island with a diminutive military capacity, declared itself neutral between Britain and Germany. The Irish felt in danger from both sides, with good reason. Winston Churchill wanted to shelter his warships in Irish ports. Some feared he would do so by force, thereby inviting German bombing. Adolf Hitler was known to view Ireland as a possible base from which to attack England. The arguments raged inside and outside the country and continued for many years after the war ended. How could a defenseless island make a difference one way or another in such a huge military theater and thus invite ruin? The opposing point of view insisted that there could be no such thing in life as a neutral position. Faced with uncalled for aggression, everyone must take sides. This debate echoes a smaller, more intimate, and much older conundrum, closer to the origin of the word. Can a man and a woman ever be neutral toward each other? Can they achieve a deep friendship that remains platonic? Or will one or the other want to move it along to a livelier or more committed state? Naturally, these issues have never been resolved globally or personally, nor are they likely to be, which is to the benefit of drama and storytelling, because the word neutrality has many shades. For example, official papers released long after 1945 show that Ireland did in fact exploit the war politically and contributed many actions to the Allied cause. As to affairs of the heart, who would ever dare to define where friendship should end and passion begin? Well, apparently, I might be numbered among those who would dare to define, because in a large way, that relationship, whether it can be platonic, is a theme in this book, as is the Second World War. The Matchmaker of Kenmare is narrated by a man called Ben McCarthy, who is the narrator and protagonist of Venetia Kelly's travelling show. At the age of 18 in Venetia Kelly's travelling show, his father, a farmer, a countryman from County Tipperary, a prosperous farmer, suddenly, one night, in a mad fit, leaves home and runs away with a beautiful actress, age 32, called Venetia Kelly, who has one of these rackety, raggedy, ramshackle, enough alliteration, travelling shows running around the country. The mother, the following morning, says to Ben, 18-year-old Ben, go out and bring your father back home. Not such an easy task. What happens is that when Venetia Kelly sees Ben, it's Ben she falls in love with. Now, as they say, read on. Well, in actual fact, there's a lot to read on, and I have to leapfrog because I'm not going to tell you what that book is in. You just have what's in that book. You just have to buy it and find out. But it did lead to this book. Ben subsequently became a travelling man, a collector for the Irish Folklore Commission, a kind of Alan Lomax. You're familiar with the name Alan Lomax of the Smithsonian, who collected jazz and all kinds of American traditions, north, south, east, and west in the United States. Ben travels for the Irish Folklore Commission, and one of his jobs is he has been tasked to produce a report called Matchmaking in Rural Ireland. We're all familiar with matchmakers. If we haven't ever known a professional one, we might have even dabbled in it ourselves. You're familiar with the phrase, to fix someone up with. And I'm sure several of the audience have already got somebody in mind for somebody else at this very moment. It usually happens. July 1943, this is Ben from his own official notes. He has called to see Kate Begley, who, as I say, lives in a place called Lamb's Head, overlooking the Atlantic in a wild part of the southwest of Ireland. Here is my note of our first meeting. She always serves tea to her callers to break the ice and soften the difficult opening question. Did you ever court a girl, and what kind of girl would you like? The men usually answer no to the first question, and to the second they might say, well, a girl who likes a laugh, or a sturdy girl, she won't object to hard work, or a girl steady in herself, or if they were fishermen, a girl who knows the sea, can work the nets. Miss Begley remarked, at this point, I might say that I know just the person, and she added, whether I do or not. The cottage hovers in a pocket above the ocean. There are no other houses on Lamb's Head. From the red door, you can see for miles across open water. Stone grows everywhere, all around, up the hill, down to the water, where rocks litter the foreshore, their white patches like medals in the sun. By land, she can hear people coming up the battered lane. If they arrive by sea, she can look down on their heads as they moor at the little jetty. Miss Begley says that since she was a very young child, she has watched for the boats, and to this day she runs back to the house to tell her grandmother how many men have made the journey. They commonly arrive on a Sunday, she says, striding up from the sea through the high, scrabby grass. Quiet men, she says, shy and big-boned. One of the first things they see is a photograph on the mantelpiece of a little girl with a ribbon in her hair and a middle-aged woman dressed in black. Dated 1923, it was posed some 20 years ago in a studio in Kenmare, the nearest town. Both are looking at the camera. The grandmother, Mrs. Holst, a widow, purses her severe lips. The girl is a little overfed and has a cautious smile. A potted palm sits on a column in the vague Egyptian background. There's no doubt that it's grandmother and granddaughter. She says that visitors comment upon the resemblance. For as long as Miss Begley can remember, the grandmother, before she undertakes to make any introductions, delivers a lecture, which Miss Begley has adopted. Quote, "Marriage is very important. Marrying a girl is the most important thing a man can do. Never mind business or politics or sport or any of that. There's nothing so vital to the world as a man marrying a woman. That's where we get our children from. That's how the human race goes forward. And if it's too late for children, there's the companionship of a safe and trusted person." End of quote. Miss Begley says that she has listened to those fireside words of her grandmother all her life, a speech that ends in a declaration, "Marriage is the gold standard of all relationships. It is the currency by which everything else is valued." I asked, "What did the visiting men think of all this?" She told me, "Very often, the father speaks for the son, who is usually asked to leave for a little while, and he'll wander out of the cottage and look at the sea. Then the father describes the son's work as, say, a fisherman in the Atlantic, the small boats, the freezing winds, the catch that might drag you overboard, and the absences lasting all night and perhaps several days if they were following herring shoals or a field of cod far out. A woman, he'll announce, would have to put up with that. And the living is hard, no doubt there. When the ice gets into your hands, it doubles the size of your knuckles." Next come some more questions. "Is there any insanity in your family? Would your wife say that you yourself were a generous man or a mean-spirited man? Is your son a decent man? Can he be depended upon not to strike a woman? That's a very cowardly thing to do, to strike a woman who hasn't the same strength as a man." If the father looks uncomfortable, she'll ask him, "Did you ever strike a woman yourself? Did you ever hit your wife?" If he says, however sheepish and apologetic, that yes, he did, the grandmother or Miss Begley will rise and say, "Well, sir, I'm afraid, like father, like son, that's what we believe in this house. And we can't do business with you. What I mean is, we won't do business with you. So go on your way." Their visitors showed up, Miss Begley said, throughout the whole year, except in the time of the gales, March or September, or the worst of the cold rain in January and February. Sometimes as many as 4 and 5 seekers of marriage came to that house on a Sunday, in boats tied up below the headland, or by road in hackney cars from Kenmare. And by the time they'd left, she said, we had shaped the rest of their lives. I grew up aware of matchmakers. I can't say that I ever actually met one. But it was a whispered profession. That is to say, the matchmakers did some whispering, and they were whispered about. Because the word poignant is never far from the word matchmaker. Think about it. If a woman goes to a matchmaker, it's usually, at least it was seen where I grew up, a declaration of failure. I haven't been chosen. Nobody has asked me. Nobody has come courting me. Can you find me a husband? I had a friend, and I draw from my knowledge of him and experience of him in this book, a wonderful Irish playwright called John B. Keane. Sadly now he's dead, but he dabbled, he told me, in matchmaking. He learned from a man called Dan Paddy-Andy, who made over 600 marriages. John made 7. And I said, how do they go, John? He said, well, he said, 5 were glorious unions. He said, the 6th, they split up within a month, and the 7th couple never spoke to me again. And I said, and how do you feel it now? He says, they don't do any more matchmaking. They performed a kind of service. My mother told me this, of a matchmaker she knew. They performed a kind of service that went beyond mere introduction. They didn't just introduce people. They actually coached people how to behave. You take an unlettered man from the Irish countryside, barely able to read and write, as in this case, Miss Begley has a man called Neddy the Drover, who with whom she's making a match. He's a drover of cattle, goes across the country taking cattle to fairs and auctions, and she's making a match with him for a girl who works in a local bakery. She has already encouraged Neddy to go to a man in Limerick who rents out teeth. Neddy has no teeth. So this man rents out dentures for weddings and funerals. There was indeed such a man in Catherine Street. And Neddy has been there. And now Neddy the drover arrives for his first date with the girl he may yet marry, and indeed yet marry. Neddy the drover trundled up, as shining as the winter sun. Ben is in the cottage in Lamb's Head with Miss Begley, and Neddy has arrived. His boots gleamed like black marble. He had a sober red tie on a white shirt and a suit of blue serge. I recognized the ring. Somewhere in his life dwelt a returned emigrant. The water with which he had plastered down his hair had dried, and he was left with strands jutting out all over his pointed head. "Hello there, miss. Hello, sir, Mr. Ben. How are you doing?" I've rarely met a man so easy to like. Miss Begley took Neddy aside and, as I learned, debated with him as to whether he objected to my presence at his wooing. He had no qualms because, as I now think, he had no concept of boundaries. It would never have occurred to him that he had any personal rights, not even something as minimal as privacy. Still, I left them alone, went indoors, and found a dim place in a far corner of the long, friendly kitchen. I could feel their buzz. They came in and sat on facing chairs. Neddy had his back to me. While she tutored him, I made notes. Her face glowed with praise. "You're nicely dressed, Edward. Well done," he nodded. "And you got the teeth?" "My mother doesn't like them." Miss Begley frowned. "Does your mother have teeth, Edward?" 31. "You mean she only ever lost one tooth? She broke it on the bone of a pork chop. My father has 30. And my two brothers, they've 30 each. And my sisters, one has the whole 32. One sister has a few gaps at the front, but she has 26 if you add up the total. Another of them has 31, and the twins, they have 30 each." He grew animated. "Miss, there's 270 teeth in our house." "But you've none. I bring down the average." Neddy had raised his voice. "That Limerick man, I went back to him. The lease on the teeth was up. And he sold them to me." "Good man, Edward, now tell me." I thought, not for the first time, difficult to believe that this woman is only in her 20s. She has the authority of a dowager. "Oh," Neddy said, "my grandfather has all his own teeth, and he's 90, like." Miss Begley rubbed her hands together. "Good. And my grandmother, she had none at all. I take after her, I suppose." Miss Begley seemed keen to slip away from things dental. She clapped her hands. "Now, Edward, did you remember? Soap and water. Miss, amn't I as clean as an infant? And what are you to say to this girl when she arrives?" Neddy sat up, straight as a spear. He groped for a reply. "Will I tell her about my teeth, like?" "No, no, no, you're to say," Miss Begley enumerated on her fingers. "First, how do you do? I've heard a lot about you. Second, when she sits down, you start by saying to her that you know a family the same name in Ballybunion. Now, do you remember her name?" "Eileen Mangan." "And what does she do for a living?" "She works in the bakery in Kenmare." "Good. And what else do you know about her?" "A fella disappointed her 2 years ago, and she mightn't be over it yet, but I'm not to say a word about it." Miss Begley, when she'd met Neddy, recognized a man with a good heart, she told me. Here's the note I made of her remarks. "In the scheme of things," one of her favorite phrases, "Edward was never going to have a decent life unless he had somebody to live it for. He's an intelligent fellow, caught in the middle of a raucous family where there's nobody married. The parents keep them all at home and take all their wages every week. He left school at the illegal age of 11, but can read and write and do numbers. As my grandmother said, he has great promise, and he's a man who'll never let anybody down." "Why," I asked, "do you call him Edward and not Neddy?" And she said, "to give him his dignity." Her behavior that afternoon illustrated her sense of respect, but didn't stop her for introducing some controls. If her hand didn't wag a finger, her voice did. "Edward, it's a big responsibility to introduce a lady to a gentleman. I'm responsible for her well-being and yours. Now, you'll be spending some time alone with her. Are you accustomed to spending time with young ladies?" "Well, I've my sisters, like." "That's different, Edward. Now, I want you to know something. You're to behave to this young lady as though she were a kind of a princess. Better than a sister. Be nice to her. Be kind to her. Smile at her." Neddy interrupted. "And haven't I the teeth for it now, miss?" "You have, Edward. You have indeed. Although his back was turned to me, I could tell that Nettie smiled at Miss Begley because she reached forward and patted him on the knee. "That's a lovely smile, Edward, lovely. Just do that and all will be well." He nodded, as earnest as a friar. "When you go for a little walk with Edward, offer her your arm." He must have seemed bemused because Miss Begley stood up and said, "Like this, stand up." She took his hand, placed it in her curved arm, and escorted him up and down the kitchen. "Always let her walk through a doorway first. That's what a gentleman does. What about a gate, miss?" "The same, Edward. A gate is a kind of door outside, isn't it?" Up and down the long kitchen they walked, turning and walking back, turning and walking back. "Not too fast and not too slow, Edward, and always making sure that she doesn't step in a puddle. And don't walk so fast that you're dragging her along behind you. And don't be so slow that she's dragging you." Miss Begley, diligent as a governess, gave demonstrations of both. "One more thing, Edward. If you feel you want to kiss her hand or kiss her cheek, kiss nothing else, you understand? Nothing else. Here, let me show you." And she kissed Neddy's weathered, menial hand, a paw of brown leather that mostly handled the rumps of cattle. And she kissed his cheek, that mottled red cheek, reamed by winds from the world's four corners. And I shall never know to this day why Neddy's new teeth didn't at that moment fly in ecstasy across the room. Mouth open as a bag, and Neddy the drover, who looked like an old shed with a new coat of paint, stood in the middle of the kitchen as pretty Miss Begley, with her hair fluffed and curled, smiled her famous smile at him, and I thought he might swoon. The book doesn't continue in that vein, or indeed drop into that vein very often. In fact, it then goes shortly after that into the pit of World War II, the point being to make as much of neutrality as possible, because Ben and Miss Begley become the closest of friends, and you wonder all the time, will they, won't they, will they marry? Well, there's a very, very easy way for you to find out, and I will sign it for you. Thank you very much. This is the fun part.
So we're happy to take questions of a dental or other nature.
Accidental nature. <yeah.
laughs> So if you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off? There's got to be one.
Nobody ever wants
not
to
five
ask
rows
the first
back.
Question. Oh, there we are.
On the aisle.
When you write your third book, will you tell us in that book whether the silver cord is wrapped around Ben and Venetia?
When I write my third book, which is the third book in this trilogy, and it's going to be called The Last Storyteller, Ben is still, I'm halfway through it at the moment, Ben is still traveling the roads as a folklore collector for the Irish government. And they used to come to our house. We knew some of these people. And you want to know, will I tell you in the last book whether the gods of matchmaking have drawn a silver cord around Ben's ankles and Venetia's ankles? I only look dumb. I'm certainly not telling you that here tonight, that's for sure. Put it this way. It is a trilogy. It wasn't meant to be a trilogy. I mean, things just grow. I'm sure you've had this experience as well, Joe. Things just grow. You're writing a novel. The novel doesn't always tell you how it's going to finish. Now, earlier books did. But, for example, I wrote a book a few years ago, a novel called Shannon, which is about a young American chaplain who travels the River Shannon in Ireland, shell-shocked in the First World War, which for some bizarre reason, and I don't quite know why, is a theme keeps coming back and back in my work all the time. If you look at the last page of the text of Shannon, there are four paragraphs on that last page, and I did not know how the book was ending until the second of those four paragraphs. I did not actually know what was going to happen. And another book that I wrote under the name Francis Bryan, which is the name of my first two sons, my third son, and I wrote the book under the pseudonym Francis Bryan. My third son is called Owen, and I have to write a book with the pseudonym Owen Owen to satisfy him. It was a sequel, a very faithful in every way, technical sequel to Treasure Island. For my own amusement, I didn't mean it ever to be published. And I couldn't finish the damn book. I was 6,500-7,000 words from the exact technical finish that Robert Louis Stevenson had in his, in terms of the number of words. And then one more, and it was all about who gets the girl. Now, and on board the ship, there is a man, a rather thoughtful man of 56, who is a single lawyer from Bristol in England. And I happened to be 56 when I was writing this book. And would you believe he gets the girl? So sometimes you don't know. But I do know how this one is going to end.
Joe, do you write novels knowing the way they're going to end, or is it something that you eventually get to?
Well, I admire Frank's bravery in setting out ever to write a novel, the end of which you don't know, because I think I learned the hard way at the start of my career that if I do that, I get lost. You know, I have to have some sort of destination before I start. So these days, you know, if I have an idea, particularly if I have a person, if I have a character, I sit down and I write 10,000 words. And if I feel it's taking off, then I stop. I don't do anything for a while. And I try and think my way down the end of the road of the story, just because, you know, you need a destination. We could all decide this moment that we're going to leave here and go to New York. And that could be the story. But, you know, there are 50 ways we could get there. We could get the train and we could get the bus. We could go to New York via Dublin. You know, there are all sorts of things we could do. It comes from very painful experiences when I was starting to write. My first novel was published in 1991, but it was actually my third or fourth go at a first novel. And the reason the earlier ones were abandoned was just because they got longer and longer and more shapeless and more baggy and more horrible without any end in sight. And there's a wonderful place in Ireland, in Annamacarrick, County Monaghan, a house, a country house that was owned by the great theatre director Tyrone Guthrie, who was a cousin of Tyrone Power, the movie star. And when Tyrone Guthrie died, he left this house to the writers and artists of Ireland. There's an irresponsible thing to do. And it's administered by the Arts Council, a branch of our government, and it's for people to go to finish a project. So you go there to work on your painting or your music or your novel or whatever it is. So I was working on this huge, big book over in London, and they allowed me to go to Annamacarrick for 3 weeks. And I decided I will not leave until I have an ending for this book. A terrible pressure to put on yourself. So the days ticked by, and it got closer and closer to my return to London. Finally, it was the day before. I still hadn't got an ending. And they have a lake there at Annamacarrick, and you're allowed to row out into the middle of the lake. So I decided I will do that, row out to the middle of the lake. I won't come back in until I have the ending. So I rowed out, and I smoked quite heavily at the time. I lifted up the oars, and the boat began to circle, and I started my pack of cigarettes. I smoked all of them, and the sky began to darken, and suddenly I actually had an epiphany. I had a little revelation, which is there is no ending to this horrible thing. So you've got to smoke your last cigarette, put the oars back out, row back, walk up to the house, get the 200,000 words and throw them in the trash, because otherwise you'll spend the next 40 years of your life doing this. So that's what I did. But because I'd put so much work into it, it was a very painful act of divorce. And so I never set out now unless I have some notion of the end. Now, of course, as Frank says, as anybody who writes knows, the destination can change and all sorts of things begin to happen when your characters come to life. Every author has had that experience where the character kind of jostles with you a bit and wrestles with you and wants a bit more of the book than you're prepared to give. And it's a sign that the book might live, because, of course, that's what the reader wants. We go to fiction because we want the character to come to life. So that can happen, and all sorts of surprises can be revealed to you. But personally, I find it helpful to have some sort of roadmap.
There's a wonderful English novelist, sadly passed away in the last year or so, called Alan Sillitoe. He wrote The Loneliness of the Long-Distant Runner. And he told me once in an interview that he had written a novel called The Death of William Posters. He derived the title from that notice you see on hoardings where there's a building construction going on, bill posters will be prosecuted. So the William posters of the title is this mythical bill posters. But when he was writing that book, he told me that the protagonist, Bill Posters, falls in love with a local village nurse. He's arrived in this village to do some work, do some construction work, and he moves in with her, he shacks up with her, and the first Saturday they have together, they have a row, and he storms out and goes down the pub in the village, and there in the pub in the village, in the first third of the book, he meets two characters who take over the entire novel. So that can happen too.
It can, yeah. It can happen in real life as well, where part of my family folklore is that I had two uncles who left Ireland for Australia in the 1950s, as many Irish people did, you know, emigrated at that time. And one of them, unusually, his fiancée went to Australia before he did. And so she was there for a few months and he set off. And you either couldn't fly or it was too expensive for him to fly. So he went on the boat and it was 6 weeks. And there's a very beautiful young woman on the boat. And he fell in love with the woman on the boat. And he used to describe to me the strange mixture of feelings as the ship pulled into Circular Quay in Sydney, seeing his fiancée waiting there for him and knowing I've got to go down the gangplank in a minute and say I've got some good news, which is that I'm safe, and I've got some bad news, which is we're not getting married. Oh, so dear. The destination can change. Yeah. And there's probably a novel there.
Right here in the third row? The
second? Yes.
There's a microphone coming to you from your right.
I read your wonderful book, Star of the Sea.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
And recommended it for our book group. And I was wondering if there's any inside stories why you wrote about the Irish potato famine. Anything that might not be in the book that I can tell?
I can tell you a few things, yeah. Well, one thing that I know Frank will have experienced as well, is when you're writing historical fiction, there's a particular set of challenges that you have to meet to do with history. I mean, you can't have characters in the book use words that haven't been invented yet, or know things that science has not discovered yet. You know, you need to be very true to life. Readers, I have found, will forgive you almost anything in a novel, except inaccuracy. If you refer to real-life events and you get them wrong, people hate that, whether it's a contemporary novel or a historical one. I had a novel published a few years ago called Inish Owen, a contemporary novel set in the Inish Owen Peninsula, part of Ireland, up in County Donegal. And about halfway through, I have a scene where a couple walk down a street in a town in Inish Owen, and I say they turned left and they passed the Catholic Church and they turned right and they passed the pub. And a woman wrote to me from Inish Owen saying, you know, I used to like your novels a lot. and I was so excited that you're writing a novel set in our part of the world. I loved it. Then I got to page 202 and everybody knows, she said, that when you walk down the street and turn left, you don't come to the Catholic Church. That's the pub. And when you turn right, you don't come to the pub. That's the cinema car park. And it ruined the whole book for me, she said. I couldn't believe a word after that. So you have that pressure. And then in historical fiction, you have even greater ones. So in the privacy of this room, and since you've been so nice about Star of the Sea, I will confess that a few historical errors crept into Star of the Sea, a novel that is set in 1847 on a famine ship leaving Liverpool, calling via Cove in County Cork in Ireland and coming to New York. So the central character of this book is a man called Pius Mulvey, and in the opening chapter he's standing on the ship, the deck of the ship, and it's at night. The ship is pulling away from Ireland for the last time. It's very, very sad. It's forlorn. Everyone back in Ireland is dying. Everyone on the ship knows they will never see Ireland again. And the ship is just drifting past the last few coastal islands off the west coast. It's very operatic and very tragic. And I thought, to sophisticate the scene slightly, I'll give this man, Mulvey, one pleasant little warm memory to take with him among all the sadness. So it's a cold, clear night, and he's looking up at the twinkling stars from the deck of the ship, and he remembers that when he was a boy, the schoolmaster taught the class a little memory device to remember the sequence of the planets from the sun, the solar system. And it is, Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights praying. And if the initial letter of each of those words is one of the planets in the solar system, so I think that's fine, lovely, nice memory to take with him. So the book comes out, a guy writes to me from the British Astrological Society to say, we have a problem here, pal, because praying, Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights, praying is P, is for Pluto. Pluto was discovered in the 1920s. Book is set in 1847. So, in fact, I discovered this summer, I read an interesting article saying we're still not absolutely sure about Pluto, whether it's there or not, but certainly nobody knew in 1847. So the book became successful, thank God. It was reprinted, so I took that out. And it was Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights. And then the same wretch wrote to me again. He could have told me the first time, but he said, there's still a problem. Because he said, Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights. Nights is N for Neptune. Neptune was discovered in 1847. So you're telling me this poor, starving, hungry, illiterate man on the deck of the ship, he's reading the scientific journals, like he's remarkably well informed. So it was as though, like, with each reprint of the book, the solar system is getting smaller. So you have to watch out for things like that in Star of the Sea. There's another scene now, I'm confessing to all of my sins. In one of the chapters, a poor man is he's in Connemara in the west of Ireland during the famine, and he hears a wolf howling in the distance, which I thought was just a kind of standard issue, evocative sound. And a guy writes to me from, you know, the Irish Wolf Appreciation Society to say, as everyone knows, that couldn't have happened. You, always in a letter, when you've been told something that nobody knows, it begins, as everybody knows.
Yes, that's right.
And he said, that couldn't have happened because the last wolf in Ireland, as everybody knows, was shot in 1792. And here's a picture of the wolf. Here's a picture of the guy who shot him. Here's how much he weighed. And at the instigation of my dear father, Sean, I did something that I never do. I wrote back to that man. I said, thank you very much for your letter, but you're mistaken. That must have been the second last wolf in Ireland, because the last wolf in Ireland is alive in 1847 in my novel, Star of the Sea. So I'm sorry to break this to you. So you have to be careful about things like that. And then also, I suppose, on a more serious level, I've come to feel, having written a few historical novels, that a mistake we often make writing now is to assume that the people of the past felt the way we do about things.
That's very difficult.
That they mourned. You know, when you think of the size of families in Ireland or in pioneer America, where people had huge families, if a child dies now in a family of two, you know, it is an absolute tragedy. You wonder how the parents will ever get over it. In those days, it's not that there wasn't grief. I know that there was. But you just wonder, did people grieve? Did they fall in love in the same way? Were they happy in the same way? When you think, like, in the 1840s, this is the world before Freud gave us an insight into how we think. It's the world.
Where they had no words for their feelings.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's the world before, you know, parliamentary democracy or feminism or even literacy, as you mentioned. Most people couldn't read. The things that we take for granted that have shaped our feelings and given us a way of expressing them just did not exist at the time. So you have to be careful about that.
Have to be even more careful in nonfiction. Confession time, I too have had an, as everybody knows, letter. Except in this case, it began, Dear Mr. Delaney, oh dear Mr. Delaney, the word imbecile springs to mind. As everybody knows, the book in question was called A Walk to the Western Isles. I wrote a book mirroring the journey of Dr. Johnson, the great dictionary maker, and his amanuensis and biographer, Mr. Boswell, who went to the Western Isles of Scotland in 1774 to see what history was like, thereby angering the Scots, who thought they were quite modern, thank you very much. But in actual fact, he did see fairly primitive society there. Well, at the end of the book, as they're coming down the west coast of Scotland, they stop at a place called Rest and Be Thankful. I had never heard of a place called Rest and Be Thankful, but there is such a place, and thereby hangs the imbecile remark. I describe in the book how they take, I had in fact heard of a place, how they take their leave, how they sit at this place where in Stevenson's novel Kidnapped, Alan Breck and David Balfour, and the phrase they use was, take their awkward manly leave of each other with a handshake at Rest and Be Thankful. And they keep going. The burden of the letter was, in actual fact, it wasn't a letter. The word imbecile was in an open postcard. Even better. The burden of the refrain was, as everybody knows, it wasn't that Rest and Be Thankful. It was the Rest and Be Thankful on the east coast of Scotland. So my editor called me in some agitation and said, the paperback is about to come out. And I said, how many people in the world know there is a place called Rest and Be Thankful, much less two places called Rest and Be Thankful? I'm actually rather proud of that error, so we'll leave it in. It's the only way I could deal with it. But even something like that, where you do not think something is so egregious, there cannot be another place called Rest and Be Thankful. But just for a moment to speak to Joseph's point about how people feel. It's extraordinarily mixed. If you were relying on the writings of the day for how people back two centuries ago or a century and a half ago thought and felt, it's very hard to judge, because the poems of the time that are expressive and the novels of the time that are expressive are by educated people, very privileged people. People who could write at that length and with that vocabulary were privileged people. They'd had an education. Where you do get an enormous amount of help is from local newspapers, which in many cases, and here in the United States it happened as well, published letters from local people, couched in local argot, and it's a marvelous guide to very strong emotions and the expression of them. But don't rely on Lord Byron and Shelley and people like that, who might have felt these wonderful emotions, but they were trained to. You know?
It's a particular problem, I suppose, in societies like Ireland in the 19th century, the world that Star of the Sea is about, because we have a lot of written sources from, you know, the landlord class in the famine. We have written sources from government, written sources from almost everybody involved, except the people doing the dying, because first of all, writing isn't part of their culture, particularly. It's an oral culture. And secondly, this society is being absolutely traumatized. You know, hundreds of thousands of people die, possibly a million in the space of 5 years, another 1.5 or 2 million people emigrate here to this country. So there's a huge silence at the heart of this experience, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write Star of the Sea. I feel that the famine has been remembered in Ireland through a sort of prism of propaganda of one kind or another. There are remarkably few novels about this massive event. We have only one that was written about the event while it was happening, a book called The Black Prophet by William Carleton. Incredible that it only produced one book. Amazing that the 1840s, when the Irish famine happens, is the high flowering point of the English novel. And we have very socially engaged, progressive novelists like Dickens who care about the poor. You know, Dickens has known poverty himself as a young man, a remarkably admirable person who does as much as he can. But you think, where is the novel of the Irish famine written by Dickens? You know, and I suppose that was one touchstone for me. I tried to make Star of the Sea, in some ways, the Irish famine novel that Dickens never got around to writing. But there is information in local newspapers. Another fascinating source for people who could write, emigrants or immigrants, as they were here, who could write, their letters are often deeply revealing about a different kind of Ireland to the one we see in the songs. I mean, every 19th century Irish-American song is really a pretty sad one. They're all, you know, very poignant. They're about missing the home place, your heart going across the Irish Sea. They're very touching. But sometimes when you read them, you wonder, is this the whole truth, you know? If I were in Philadelphia in 1850 and I'd made it over here and I'd survived the journey and I wasn't starving and I had a job and I met a nice girl and we settled down and got married, I don't know that I'd be missing Ireland all that much, you know, all the time. Why isn't there one song about that? And when you turn to the letters, you see this time and again. In Star of the Sea, I think there are copies here on sale, very few of them, but you can see it again, you can get it from the library here. I interspersed the chapters with quotes from actual letters, and I remember there's a beautiful one from a 17-year-old girl called Mary Brown, I think, in Wexford, and she's writing to her cousin back at home, and she's saying, you know, it's great here in America, the boys are very handsome, I've learned to speak English. If you saw me now, you'd think I was an absolute Yank. She says, at home, none of the boys were interested in me. Here, they're all trotting after me, she writes. And the great thing of all, she finishes her letter with, is that the priests in America are far more merciful in confession. They don't give you a penance as strict as the one at home. So you see, people's reasons for emigrating, as now, were far more diverse, you know, than we think. So there's some texture and, I suppose, reality to be found, as Frank says, in newspapers and sometimes in emigrant letters.
Shortly after I read Joe's book, Star of the Sea, about a couple of months later, I got a package in the post from a man called Marcus Burke. Marcus Burke is the treasurer of the County Tipperary Historical Society, which is an excellent society, which does marvelous papers in an annual review, and I've found it tremendously useful. But the package was particularly touching because it was a series of rather poor photostats, the old photographic photostats, all in my father's handwriting. The Irish Folklore Commission tasked country school teachers to gather local folklore. And these amateurs, like my father, went out, and I went out with him as a child, and he collected cures that worked on animals and humans. He collected epitaphs, and he collected famine reminiscences. And reading his factual accounts of interviewing the one generation descendants of people who had lived through the famine, and his own description of his own grandfather describing the famine, and then reading your book side by side, kind of made the whole thing into an amazing fusion for me. And suddenly it came alight, and I had a sudden memory of my mother telling her sister, my Auntie Myra from Limerick, why my father was so awkward about people coming to the house unannounced during a meal. If kids came to look for us, we actually happened to be at the kitchen table having what we called dinner, which was lunch, or having tea, which we called dinner, on a summer evening, they were made to wait outside. If a neighbor came, he'd be put in the parlor until we were finished. They weren't invited in. And my aunt was railing about this. She had a lot to rail at about my father. My aunt was railing about this to my mother, and my mother said, he's embarrassed. And she said, why? She said, he's embarrassed to see how much we might have on our table compared to what other people might have. And my aunt said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. And my mother, in a dismissive way, said, that's an old famine thing. So, years later, I pressed her on this. And she said, the dominant feeling in Ireland, her grandfather told her, the dominant feeling about the famine was embarrassment. We weren't able to feed ourselves. And that's possibly why the novelists kept away from it. I can't think. I knew of the Carleton book, but I've never read it. But as far as I'm concerned here, sitting here tonight, there are two great books about the famine.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.